Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
It's Gary LeMaster. I'm filling in for Mike Cosentino today.
And we have a guest with us in the studio, Taylor McKinnon, and he has a really great title. He works for the Grand Canyon Trust, and his title is Director of Energy. I think it's the best title I've heard in quite a while. Taylor, say hello.
Hello. Thanks for catching the nuance there.
At my age, I wish I had the energy.
Where do we start? Let's start with talking about uranium mining around the Grand Canyon. The name of your organization is the Grand Canyon Trust. Part of your job is protecting the Grand Canyon, right, or trying to.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening with uranium mining? I know many of our listeners want to know. They hear all these stories. They hear the stories of what happened to the uranium miners back in the 40s, so forth and so on.
Yeah, the story of uranium mining is really one that expands beyond Grand Canyon and is really a story of the Four Corners region and the Colorado Plateau, which is the part of the world, northern Arizona and Utah and western Colorado, that we work at Grand Canyon Trust to protect and restore. Uranium mining began in our region in the 1940s as a result of the federal government's efforts to acquire uranium in support of its atomic weapons programs. And thousands of mines were built in those times, in the 40s and 50s, in addition to upgrader sites where the uranium was concentrated and mills where it was processed. And a lot of that happened on the Navajo Nation. In fact, it's probably the Navajo Nation, one could argue, really bore the brunt of a lot of that early development. Later in the 70s and 80s up into the early 90s, there were pushes for uranium development in support of nuclear energy, developing uranium in our region for nuclear energy. And that's certainly been the case more recently with the last boom or attempted boom that occurred in the mid 2000s. The price of uranium again spiked around 2007, and corresponding to those rising prices, we see rising interest from the industry to develop uranium resources. So
where is most uranium mined in the United States? Is it mined on the Colorado Plateau or areas near the plateau?
You know, I haven't run the numbers in terms of where most of it is. I suspect it's on the Colorado Plateau, and I suspect historically it's been on the Colorado Plateau, especially in terms of conventional mining. Conventional mines where they're excavating deposits. But the history of all that, mining, dating back to the 40s. So that's a 70 year history in our region of uranium development. It's left a legacy of pollution that I think demarcates one of the great environmental injustices in America's history. On the Navajo Nation, there are hundreds of abandoned mines and even some upgrader sites, concentrator sites that have not been reclaimed. There are aquifers and wells and streams that are contaminated. There are vast areas of contaminated soil and dust and high radiation, and people living amidst these conditions right now, people without safe drinking water, high rates of cancer, birth defects, these are conditions that exist today. It's not just on the Navajo Nation either. There are thousands of abandoned uranium mines on public lands throughout the West and in the Four Corners region too. So the prospect of new mining and more mining is cast against a history wherein we have stark legacy pollution problems and stark outstanding needs to clean up the pollution that was left over from the past development.
So what happened to these past developments? There's a uranium mine. I closed the uranium mine. I'm a private company. Do I have to clean it up? Do I have to do anything? Or is it a minimal amount of... How come there are so many abandoned uranium mines that we don't even know whether they're polluting? We don't even know... we don't have a lot of details on them, or do we?
We don't, especially the different mines from the different eras were administered under different laws. The early mines were not subject to a lot of the public lands and natural resource laws that came into force in the 1960s and 70s. And so they predated a lot of the newer regulations that we have in place. And that constitutes most of the thousands of abandoned mines that we have in the West. But even with mines that are administered on public lands under the public lands laws, again, since the 60s or 70s, there are problems that attend those. And we see those problems locally and regionally. Case in point being the mines around the Grand Canyon. These are mines that were approved in the 1980s. They were constructed in the 1980s, late 80s and early 90s. When the uranium market crashed in the 1990s, those mines went on to what's called standby, where they're essentially shuttered and left to sit until the uranium mining companies decided that they would like to reopen them and continue operation, which was just in the last 2, 3, 4 years that that's occurred. So from the early 90s all the way up until the late 2009, 2010, 2011, those mines sat dormant, and there were real pollution problems that occurred in the interim. Federal agencies, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, which administers public lands north of the Grand Canyon National Park, and the U.S. Forest Service, which administers the national forest land south of the park, has not required those mining companies to update their 1980s environmental reviews and public reviews. So what that means is that the mines have been allowed to reopen without considering new science, all the new science that's been promulgated since the 1980s, and there's a lot of it, and without considering new circumstances that have arisen since those environmental and public reviews, things like the introduction of California condors or rise in tourism and tourism traffic and recreation on those public lands. And it disregards a lot of people in our society who were born after the late and mid-1980s when those approvals happened. There's actually a petition circulating among NAU students and high school students in northern Arizona to compel the Forest Service to redo the environmental impact statement, the public environmental review for the Canyon Mine, because all of those people were born after the original decision and have thus been foreclosed from any participation in the planning of that mine. And really its impacts, if it does operate, it's their generation that will bear those consequences.
And it's so, old science. In other words, they're regulated by 30, even 40-year-old science rather than the latest discoveries.
Right. They're by definition administered under environmental reviews that occurred and public input that occurred in the 1980s. And so it's by any measure outdated, and it's been pretty disappointing to see the federal agencies and the Obama administration defend that position in court. We've had them in court now twice on these mines, and they have vigorously defended the position that they need not and should not update 1980s era environmental reviews.
And this is done by a Democratic administration, not a Republican administration. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe we could talk about how the whole process works. I think people probably don't have a firm grasp on how what happens to be able to mine on public property.
Mm-hmm.
It's about selling off leases, is it not? And the federal government or the ownership of the property selling leases to mine, is that true?
Yeah. I'll try to explain the process. At the outset, it's important to recognize that mining on public land is administered under the 1872 mining law, the general mining law. And that's a law that came into force in American history in a time when our country was seeking to facilitate and promote westward expansion. And so it was one of many means by which the federal government could enable the creation of an economic infrastructure in the West that would, generate taxes and form the economic basis to form a society, ultimately. That was the thinking. So this is an old law, and that's an important backdrop to this, the way that one would go about.
But we don't get almost any money from hard rock mining, do we, the public, because of this old law?
That's correct. It's a subsidy. It's designed to subsidize the industrialization of the public
lands.
So
they're chewing up our national forest, and we're not the American taxpayers and citizens are not getting anything but a uranium mine that they make the profit on. We're not collecting much in the way of royalties, right, for all this destruction to our environment.
Yeah, reform proposals have included royalties. So that's been a bone of contention with the law. Another has been the lack of reclamation requirements. I think the biggest issue is the purported supremacy that the law affords mining on public lands, at least the way that the federal agencies have interpreted it. It's a supreme use. It often eclipses other uses of the public lands. And so our public lands are administered according to the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, the Federal Policy Land and Management Act, the National Forest.
So if people are hunting and fishing in an area and somebody wants to put in a uranium mine, the uranium mine has precedence over the hunting and fishing capacity of the area or hiking or whatever.
By the federal agency's interpretation of the law, yes. The answer to that question is often yes. So the way that one would go about developing a mine would be first to go out and find where one would think there'd be a deposit, and you would stake a claim there, which would mean you'd put a stake in the ground and at the corner of the parcel that you are staking a claim on, and you would register that and pay a small fee. And then in order to develop a mine there, you would first need to conduct exploratory drilling to obtain ore samples that would suggest that the quality and quantity of ore constitutes what's called an economically viable discovery. That is, the federal government, the law says that in order for the federal government to validate a mining claim and allow mining to happen, exploratory drilling needs to first occur, and we need to validate that there is actually a real economically viable mineral deposit. Passing that test, and it's called a validity exam, passing that test then establishes valid existing rights. And once one has obtained valid existing rights, they're subject to takings. It's essentially a property right, effectively. And that clears the way for mining, which is now subject to, an environmental and public review under the National Environmental Policy Act, but that's really a matter of analysis and disclosure. It can constrain and shape the way that the mining occurs, but in most cases, the mining, in the vast majority of cases, the mining does proceed. So
that can build roads to the mine mm-hmm. through previously unroaded areas, or
mm-hmm.
so they have when they have the right to the claim, they have a right to a road or and a claim, or do they just usually get it? I mean, what's the
if the adjacent, in most cases, if the adjacent public lands rules and designations allow for there to be a road, then a road can and will be built. There are some cases where that would be precluded.
So when they start mining, it sounds like there's little to no money that goes to the public, to the taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much all extracted, and the money goes to the corporations that are that have the rights to mine that property. Is that correct?
Well, there are no royalties, but there are certainly taxes that are imposed on spending money. And when they spend money, there's some money that comes into the tax coffers, but there are not royalties that are imposed.
Is there are the mining companies compelled to restore the land once they're done with it?
The reclamation standards vary. The short answer is yes. The longer discussion is whether those are adequate. And, for example, the plans governing the mines around the Grand Canyon, allow for the company to dump excess waste rock, uranium waste rock, back into the mine shaft after they're through, and then, bury and seal that, which we see is a problem because those, mine shafts and the breccia pipes can be conduits for downward migration of water through the geology and into the deep aquifers. And so if we have uranium that's been mined and is thus now soluble, water soluble and easily dissolved, then we have a pollution vector that's been buried immediately above the deep aquifers that will remain in place in perpetuity. And in our part of the world, where it's dry and where there's very little surface water, those aquifers are very, very important. They're important because they feed springs. In fact, in the Grand Canyon, the only perennial surface water, aside from the Colorado River, is aquifer-fed springs and streams.
Is there any evidence that these uranium mines, not new ones proposed, but even the old ones or ones that are restarted, and I forgot your term for it. Is there any evidence that that's beginning to pollute the springs? Because anybody who's hiked in the Grand Canyon knows without the springs, wow. And
right.
The water would end up in the Colorado River, too.
Well, yeah. So if you hike in the Grand Canyon, you know how you start to pay very careful attention to where there's water for obvious reasons. The most poignant example of, to answer your question, is the old Orphan Mine on the South Rim. And it's a mine that was grandfathered into the designation of Grand Canyon National Park. It was originally, I believe, a copper mine and then later turned into a uranium mine. And it mined these breccia pipes, these vertical columns in the geology that accumulate uranium. Is one of the earliest breccia pipe mines, and it's located right along the right along the South Rim, just to the west of the village. And
is it the one that we walk by when we walk along the rim of the canyon?
It may be if you're out on the West Rim. There used to be an old head rig there. It's now the rig's been removed, the scaffolding or the big metal structure's been removed, and it's fenced off because of radiological pollution in the soil up there. But below that mine and where the where it intersected the deep aquifers and was above the deep aquifers is Horn Creek. And the water in Horn Creek has been measured to contain about upwards of 300 micrograms per liter of dissolved uranium. For context, the federal standard there is 30 micrograms per liter. So over 100. Okay, I'll mess up my math on the radio. over 10 times the.
Anyway, too much radioactivity.
So it's made its way, in that case, it made its way into the aquifer and then into the surface water. At the Pine Nut Mine, this is a more recent mine north of the Grand Canyon, one that was built in the 80s and then put on standby when the, BLM allowed the mining company to go reopen that a few years ago. The mining company found almost 3 million gallons of water in that mine. It had been previously excavated in the 1980s.
So that's water mixed with uranium tailings and remnants or what?
We've acquired a document indicating that there was actually ore stored in that, previously, and then
wonderful,
and then it filled with water. So it's nearly 3 million gallons of water. When they dewatered it, they measured its dissolved uranium content, and that water contained upwards of 1,800 micrograms per liter of dissolved uranium. Again, the federal standard is 30. The question that we now have is whether that water, those 3 million gallons and 3 million gallons of water, exerts a lot of downward pressure. It's a lot of weight. Our question now is, did that contaminated water make it into the aquifer beneath the Pine Nut Mine, and has it made it into the springs adjacent to that along the North Rim and Kanab Creek? And I believe that the USGS is right now investigating that question, but this is precisely the concern that we've had with these mines, because once a deep aquifer is contaminated, it's impossible to clean it up. There's no way that you're going to remediate an aquifer that's thousands of feet below hard rock. And in a region where that's really the only water we've got, it's a very, very high price to pay for a very, very long time, for many, many generations, for a one-shot mining endeavor.
Politicians always seem to push mining operations by talking about the jobs that they bring. When we're talking about a uranium mine, how many jobs are we actually talking about?
I'd have to go look back at the numbers, but it's been far less than the industry's claims and some of the politicians' claims. We actually commissioned a report a few years ago at Grand Canyon Trust to take a very hard look at that, to have some economists take a very hard look at it. And it's really a drop in the bucket, especially when you look at the regional tourism economy, which is that's the real bread and butter for our region, is people coming here to visit, to experience, to hike in the Grand Canyon, to need to have clean springs to drink from. That's the real bread and butter in our region. If I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, I think it's 20 to 40 employees for one of these mines. It's not many.
And they're not long-term jobs. I mean, they may last for a decade or more, but compared to the tourism industry, it's really a drop in the bucket.
They're not long-term jobs. I mean, these mines have been on the landscape since the 1980s. The mines that are around Grand Canyon right now, I don't think any of them has operated for more than 5 years. So, it's fits and starts and actually right now, owing to a downturn in the market, Energy Fuels, the company that administers and owns those mines, has announced that they're gonna close them again. So these are not long-term careers. These are short-term, and potentially hazardous to your health jobs that spring up and then go away. So politicians who are claiming, or industry representatives who claim that this is a significant contribution to our regional economy are wrong. They're plainly wrong, and they need to factor into their math about the economics all of the costs that are externalized by these companies and imposed upon the public that we have to pay through our tax dollars. So
let's talk about externalization. You have a uranium mine, and you have the internal cost, but you like to transfer a lot of the costs. They're called externalities, mm-hmm. I think. And who ends up paying for the externalities? I mean, well, you have a coal mine and it pollutes. Who pays for that in the end? You get something from the coal company under new regulations, but long term, all these industries seem to try to externalize, push onto the public the costs of cleaning up the messes that the industries create. And so then you don't get a fair sense of what it's actually costing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, what the uranium mine is delivering also includes the amount of damage it does to the environment, which taxpayers and citizens end up paying.
If I could use an example from my own experience, say, you know, Coke Refining was once a short-term client of mine, and they were found guilty of polluting the groundwater and the aquifers in southern Minnesota. And they were fined the largest fine in the history of the EPA and of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The fine, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, was $10 million. You know, sounds like a significant fine. It actually equaled less than the net profit of one day of the refinery. So, you know, when we talk about the long-term consequences for the environment and for the public in general, the consequences to the corporations in these cases is often quite small.
Yeah, it's a fairly ubiquitous theme. The way that I like to bring it home in the context of the uranium mining is if one of our aquifers becomes polluted and contaminated with the uranium and other compounds that can move from mines into the aquifers, how much would it cost to remediate that aquifer? How much would it cost for us to be able to ensure that we again have a clean aquifer that people can drill wells into for drinking water, that a clean aquifer that feeds clean water into the springs that they feed? And the fact of the matter is there isn't the technology that exists to remediate one of these deep aquifers. There, you can't have a bond big enough to ensure that that cleanup can happen. It's permanent damage. It's permanent irretrievable damage. Even in shallow aquifers that have been contaminated in our region from uranium mills, for example, like around Milan, New Mexico, the EPA has thrown I don't know how many millions of dollars at that effort, as has industry, as a responsible party there. But those efforts to remediate even shallow aquifers have failed. And so the consequence is that water that people depend upon for drinking, water that people depend upon for agriculture, for ranching, is suddenly unusable, and absent clean surface water, So too then is the country. You know, the country becomes unusable, or becomes a lot more expensive to be there because you have to haul water in. And so the long-term costs of this kind of pollution are high, and they're intergenerational. And I think if you went out to a place like Milan, New Mexico, or if you went out to a place like Church Rock, New Mexico, or any number of other areas in the Four Corners region that are dealing with the legacy pollution, you could talk to anybody and of any political persuasion, you know, be they a conservative rancher or a, you know, lefty recreationist, and you know, the damage to that water is a unifying principle, and it's, and I think they'd all say it's, no, it's not worth it.
What is the Grand Canyon's Trust? And you're the director of energy at the Grand Canyon Trust. What is its greatest concern about uranium mining on the Colorado Plateau? And for, I guess, folks coming in from the internet, Colorado Plateau is a huge, huge plateau covering parts of Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
What's your greatest concern as an organization, or yours as the director of energy?
It's long-term radiological and toxic pollution, irretrievable pollution, and pollution whose decay rates are so slow that once it happens, it's going to inflict our region for generations upon generations. It's permanent damage, and that's our concern. Damage not just to human health, but to all the other creatures that live in our region. So,
which is filled with unique people and mm-hmm. and unique critters of all kinds.
Lots of biological and lots of cultural diversity in our region, certainly.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about one of the things that you had mentioned off air or before we went on air. Was that there are deposits of oil, shale, and tar sands in the region, which I was unaware of.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at the possibility of eventually having mining similar to what's going on in Alberta that would result in the, you know they're trying to ship the oil by pipeline to through the U.S. all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. How much oil, shale, and tar sands are there here, and how soon are we potentially looking at?
Well, taken together, the deposits on the Colorado Plateau and in the Colorado River Basin of oil, shale, and tar sands contain what the USGS estimates that they contain upwards of a trillion barrels of oil. For perspective, that's as much oil as society has burned since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. So it's a vast resource. But it's important to note that these are unconventional fuels. These aren't liquid hydrocarbons. They're rocks. And so as with the Alberta tar sands, turning them into a usable fuel requires mining them and then heating them and melting them and then extracting the usable hydrocarbons from that. So before you even get to, you know, crude oil or equivalent crude oil, as one would tap with a conventional oil well, before you even get there, you have a tremendous amount of energy input. That makes these fuels very energy intensive. For the amount of energy you get, you have to invest much, much more than with conventional oil. The consequence of that is that the carbon emissions that attend developing a barrel of crude from oil, shale, or tar sands far exceed the carbon emissions necessary to develop a barrel of conventional oil. So as light, sweet crude, as conventional oil supplies wane, we have a choice as a society to pursue more efficient means of transportation and better and cleaner technologies and to invest in that. Or we can go the other route of pursuing these ever more energy intensive and carbon intensive fossil fuels. And with the backdrop of global warming and the IPCC saying that in order to stay below dangerous thresholds of warming, we need to, you know, stay within a carbon budget globally in coming decades, moving to these high carbon fuels is really the exact wrong policy choice for us.
So not only is it not conservation and cutting down use, but it's using sources that are more polluting than the sources that we used in the past, which would be natural gas and crude oil.
Yeah. As time goes on, we sort of assume that we'll get better and better at developing more efficient and cleaner technologies, even in the realm of, you know, fossil fuel production. But this is a case where that's exactly not true. It's a step backwards. It's a step away from efficiency. It's a far, far less efficient and far, far more polluting form of obtaining liquid hydrocarbons.
Of concern to this area, doesn't it also require the use of water for the process?
It does, and it's hotly debated how much water. The low end estimates have been sort of a one to one or a 1-to-3 ratio of barrels to water, which is a lot of water. It's still a lot of water, but there's another facet to the water that's really important in a region. I use the word region pretty broadly here. A region including Tucson and Phoenix and Southern California and Las Vegas, a region whose future is tied inextricably to the Colorado River water. We should be leading the way with water and carbon thrifty energy development. We should be pioneering that path because we stand to lose the most from regional warming and drying. Scientists at the Scripps Institute are already predicting that owing to climate change, Colorado River flows will decline by up to 30% in coming decades. That's atop a river that's already over allocated. There's more water allocated than actually exists in that river. We're already seeing pretty dramatic cutbacks on use. We're seeing, drought conditions right now that are historic. So in the face of more people using more water and a river that has less water and that's already over allocated, going down the road regionally of these water and carbon intensive and water taxing through warming fuels is really we're stepping on our own toes. We're shooting ourselves in our own, probably in both feet at once by pursuing that.
I often hear people, in my neighborhood talk about, that they don't believe the science of global warming and think it's all a hoax. Then I hear, it's a largely retirement community, and I hear a lot of people talk about, well, it's not going to affect me, so, therefore I don't, I'll be long gone by the time there's a water shortage or problems with the climate. How would you respond to people like that?
Well, these are at their core issues of intergenerational equity. This is all about whether or not we're leaving a region and an environment and an America that is better than how we found it. And I'm of the mind that a duty of being a citizen is to undertake actions and support policies that leave our progeny, our kids and grandkids and their kids, in a better position than we've been in. And energy choices in our region is an energy exporting region, are one of the areas where those questions really come home. And they are really, we're at a point in time right now where we're making really very important choices that will entrain our energy use and water use regionally for a long time. So these are really important policy choices that bear on, two or three generations out.
It's an issue that I believe that we need to be extremely conservative with, in that, let's say all the scientists are wrong and global warming isn't happening and it isn't being caused by man. What are the consequences if they're right? Long term, it's almost complete destruction, environmental destruction. And if they're wrong and we go about finding alternative uses for alternative energy, you know, the only real consequence of that is we spend perhaps a little more money, but we end up with something that makes our environment better and the air cleaner and the water cleaner. So it seems kind of like the ultimate conservative issue.
At worst, yeah, that's right. At worst, we invest in creating clean, renewable energy systems that will be far more sustainable in our region in the long term, that won't and can't be exhausted, that won't force the next generation to have to find the next fix. It's investing in a much more stable and much more environmentally responsible energy framework. And it's time. I think that the data suggests that it's past time for us to begin looking at what those long-term solutions are.
We just passed the milestone that scientists feared the most was, isn't it 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere? And we've passed it once before and it abated over the winter and now it's back.
We've gone past 350, which was a milestone. We've passed 400, which is a milestone. The way that the science community is framing our emissions is in terms of a carbon budget. And we have, over coming decades, so much carbon that we can emit into the atmosphere globally. That corresponds to a certain amount of fossil fuels that can be burned. In order to stay below, and that's in order to stay below dangerous thresholds of warming, even right now, in order to stay within that carbon budget and to avoid those dangerous thresholds, we need to be leaving a majority of the world's known fossil reserves in the ground. That's what's already known. And so those are difficult facts that argues against any further exploration. We already have what we know we can safely burn. We don't need to be looking for more. And it certainly argues against pursuing these high carbon unconventional fuels like tar sands and oil shale. So these are, you know, when you look into the facts and look into the science underlying the carbon budget, it's a very sobering situation. But in crisis is always opportunity, and we are at a pivotal time in history when we can make some choices to improve things and choose different, softer, more sustainable energy paths.
We're talking with Taylor McKinnon, who's the Director of Energy for the Grand Canyon Trust. Tell us a little bit about your organization. You've worked for the Center for Biological Diversity.
I've worked for the Center for Biological Diversity in the past. I'm now Energy Director at Grand Canyon Trust, and we're a regional conservation organization focused on protecting and restoring the Colorado Plateau, which is northern Arizona, north of the Mogollon Rim. We're in Sedona. We're right at the foot of the Colorado Plateau. It extends northward up through all the canyon country in Utah and over into western Colorado. And so our work focuses in four areas: energy that I oversee, water, Native America, and land.
Before we run out of time, would you mention your website?
www.grandcanyontrust.org.
Okay, and then one other thing I'd like to mention is Taylor is speaking at the Democrats of the Red Rocks, and you can see his presentation on what is the website? D-O-R-R.
Democrats of the Red Rocks .org, and have a videotape of Taylor's presentation. Will be on the air in a few days, I think. And anyway, we want to thank him for coming and spending some time talking with us today. And thank you for your work on conservation. And I don't have too much more to say about the Grand Canyon Trust, except check out the website, folks. It's a membership organization. You can join and contribute to it, to their efforts to protect the environment in our particular area.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.